Hello, this is Todd Satterston from 800 CEO Read and author of the 100 Best Business Books of All Time. And today I'm talking with one of the authors from our one of the books we chose, Strat Sherman. He is the co-author of Control Your Destiny or Someone Else Will. He co-authored it with Noel Tishy. And Strat, thanks for joining me today.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'd love to start with, you know, this will be a relatively short interview, so I'd love to start with, give folks the elevator pitch for, you know, Control Your Destiny or Someone Else Will. I mean, it's a book that came out in 94. It might be a book that people have sort of passed in the bookstore but not picked up. What's Control Your Destiny about?
Basically, Control Your Destiny or Someone Else Will is the case study of what Jack Welch did to transform General Electric during the first, the first half of his 20-year tenure at GE. He took a very successful but very conservative, slow-growing, stodgy company and turned it into the most valuable company in the United States, increasing its market value from, I think, $13 billion to $450 billion. And he also created a group acknowledged as the world's best management team, the company with the greatest skill at change, and he essentially introduced a way of thinking about very large-scale organizational change and put it into practice and proved that it worked. And Control Your Destiny is the study of what that's about.
That's what I think is particularly interesting, you know, about Jack Welch, is the fact that he took this company that it was stodgy, but it was growing. I mean, by most, you know, if we go all the way back to 81, I mean, most people wouldn't look at GE and have said, gosh, it needed this wholesale change. But what he was able to successfully do is you know, against his detractors, against both inside and outside the company, he was able to change the course of the company to the results that you talked about. And I think that's bigger than what happened at GM or IBM in the 90s. So can you talk to me about, you know, sort of with as much time as you've kind of spent on the topic, talk about, you know, what it took to make that kind of change, you know, taking a company that's good and really trying to make it great.
Well, obviously the hardest thing to do is to create change when people feel that they're successful. GE was, when Welch arrived, one of the most admired companies in the world, had every reason to be complacent, and indeed was complacent. But as he noticed, the company was growing with the GNP, you know, low single-digit percentage rate of annual growth per year. It was dealing with fairly old technologies, light bulbs and locomotives, at a time when, you know, silicon chips were starting to happen. It was almost entirely a U.S. company, and to the degree it had sales overseas, it was just exporting U.S. products to foreign markets. And he saw that basically there wasn't a great future for this. And so, in effect, with the approval of the board of directors, he blew it up. And he did it in some quite powerful ways. He insisted that the company needed to be number one or number two in every one of its markets. And if it wasn't meeting that standard, GE would fix, close, or sell the unit that had failed to make the grade. Well, when he backed up that idea with action and started selling off things like television sets, was a tremendously shocking divestiture for GE. It made the front page of newspapers all across the country. Everyone said the world is going to hell in a handbasket if GE is no longer making TVs. But Welch proved in action that he wasn't kidding about being number one or number two. And that that policy, among other things, lit a fire under this previously complacent organization, and they started doing what it took to become number one, to become number two. And as the portfolio of businesses shifted in that direction, the value creation power of the company changed dramatically, and that's where the economic growth came from.
I also love the story that you know, and maybe you can back this up with more detail, the story that, you know, 10, I think it was 10 or 15 years into it, you know, this number one or number two message had been, you know, thoroughly integrated into the company, but then it was starting to get almost played with a little bit by managers within the company, that it was getting relatively easy to look like you were number one or number two within a company. And some of the folks he was teaching teaching a class at Crotonville said, you know, people are kind of really making, it's really easy to do this now. And he went back yet again, continued this message, but made people redefine the markets that they were in. And I just think that's another really good example of this sort of continuing to push the change initiative, even, you know, years into this message.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting about what happened at GE under Welch is this number one or number two thing was a fairly crude instrument. Mm. You know, to get a change project launched, you know, you need to capture people's attention, and that's what this was about. But the more important thing I think that occurred there is that they launched something called Workout, which was initially just a matter of getting a bunch of people in a factory or whatever to talk about how they could get rid of unnecessary work. But it turned into a process of learning, of institutionalized exploration and learning, in which people, you know, across hierarchical levels would converse about things that people in companies just didn't talk about. They'd bring in their customers to participate in sessions that were highly self-critical, and the outcome would be to improve their processes. You know, famously, they, in their locomotive division, they brought in some of their the buyers of those locomotives who pointed out that, you know, the wiring system in a certain part of the locomotive was highly susceptible to breakdown, and they ended up making a very simple fix that lowered the cost of ownership for the locomotive buyers tremendously. That kind of idea instituted a culture of reflection and candor and learning that drove change, that really is at the essence of what GE accomplished. And to be honest with you, this is the piece that I don't think has been very well assimilated by the larger world. People who think they've learned the lessons of GE simply because they know about number one and number two miss the much subtler and, in my mind, much more important message of what does it take to create an organization that's institutionally, consistently capable of learning and continuous improvement.
Let's talk about the legacy piece a little bit, because that seems like the next piece to this is, you know, on the one part, it seems like there's still lessons to learn, as you just said. But what do you think is the long term? How do you think history is going to end up judging Welch? You know, after this 20-some year tenure there, we now have ML, who's been running the company for a number of years, and we're sort of looking at, you know, what's been left. What is it that we have now? And so, what do you think the legacy question is going to be as we look back?
To be honest with you, I feel better and better and better about the sort of carefully crafted assessment that we made of the Welch tenure and Control Your Destiny, or someone else will. You know, we never bought into the idea that Jack Welch was some sort of superhuman genius. And, you know, by the end of Jack's career, people were heaping adulation upon him, you know, to a degree that just struck us as inappropriate. He was great, but not that great. And similarly, since he's retired and you know, accounting rules have changed in a way that make a highly financially oriented company like GE much harder to manage. And Immelt's performance certainly has not matched that of Welch in terms of value creation. And I think that has led people to discount Welch's achievements, and probably in an exaggerated way. I think there's a middle ground here where the truth lies. And the truth is that Welch was unquestionably one of the very great corporate leaders of all time. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But he wasn't perfect. He wasn't a guy who left behind something for his successor that was capable of sustaining what had been achieved during his own tenure. So I think the nuanced understanding is that Welch was an innovator in the realm of large-scale organizational change who discovered, tested, and proved methods that have been absolutely essential, I think, for the growth of the global economy since then, and the extent of which has still not been fully explored by other leaders. And, he was a he was a very human guy. He wasn't perfect. There was some stuff that contributed to, the extraordinary financial performance, and especially the consistent growth quarter after quarter after quarter over 20 years with only, I think, about three interruptions. That's something that's actually not repeatable and that cannot be expected of people in an era of Sarbanes-Oxley and just a different set of ground rules.
So what is it that created Jack Welch then? What is it, I see references in your book and in other places that he was, a student of Drucker. What is it that you think sort of, if I'm the young leader now trying to, appreciate all the things that he did, learn all the things he did, where are the places that I should go to get the lessons that I need and the experience that I need to be successful?
Well, I think the starting point is to be a learner. I think that was Jack's great strength. He was a guy who liked change. He felt good about it, didn't frighten him. He was tremendously excited by the idea of getting the best idea no matter where it came from. He had an ego for sure, but he wasn't susceptible to the kind of ego that makes people only like their own ideas. He would take a good idea no matter where it came from. And certainly he was a student of Peter Drucker, who was, played a major role in GE's history. But he was omnivorous. He would bring in the best minds he could get absolutely anywhere. I think in my own work, since writing this book, I've been trying to put this set of ideas and this understanding into practice. I've got a small change form called a compli in which I do this. And what I see is that the great obstacle for companies that are trying to create needed change essentially boils down to the human piece. It essentially boils down to the reluctance of people to face reality, to have candid conversations, to create informal cultures, to absorb the best ideas no matter where they are, and to be hungry for learning. That's the thing that I think Welch brought to the table as a matter of his character. It was not something necessarily that he learned. I think it was something about the way he was that was incredibly fortunate. But I do think that mindset of eagerness to learn, openness to change, openness to candor and informality, and the conditions that will enable a group of people to put onto the table their best ideas, that really is the engine of the success that GE had, and that's the piece that I think people can replicate no matter what their particular character happens to be.
Seems like the perfect place to stop. So we've been talking about Control Your Destiny, or someone else will, with Strat Sherman. Strat, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.